The Fourth District Appellate Court of the State of Illinois has now convened. The Honorable John W. Turner presiding.
Thank you. Glad to get the technical difficulties out of the way. We're here on case number 4210194, People versus Fields. Will counsel for the appellant please identify yourself?
This is Gregory Peterson of the Office of the State Appellate Defender. I'm here on behalf of Jaquay Fields.
And counsel for appellee, please identify yourself.
Kim Nocke on behalf of the people of the state of Illinois.
Thank you, Mr. Peterson. You may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, counsel, as just stated, this is Gregory Peterson of the Office of the State Appellate Defender. I represent Jaquay Fields in this matter. I want to stress that we stand by all of the arguments in our opening and reply briefs. The stop was pretextual. The FOID Act is not strict liability, and Ms. Fields was not reckless in not knowing that her FOID had been revoked. But I would like to start with the supplemental brief and giving the court's interest in those questions. So the questions that this court asks, as I'm sure it's well aware, go to whether or not the state could have proved and whether the jury was put on notice that the state was trying to prove Section 21A of the FOID Act, which is about not having possession of a FOID card. And I want to make sure that I answered this court's questions sufficiently. But the record is absolutely replete with evidence that she did have her FOID card on. You see that both on the video and on the testimony, both at the suppression hearing from both Ms. Fields and the officer in question, and the officer's testimony at trial. Given that the card was in her possession, that eliminates any chance of her being charged with a violation of Section 21A, which is about not having your card in your possession. And that's there from the plain language of the pattern jury instruction. So if this court has any further questions about the supplemental briefing, I'd be happy to ask it. Otherwise, I'd turn to what was briefed in our opening brief. Seeing
none. Any questions, so please proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. The state and I agree in this matter that the FOID Act is, in the relevant parts, silent as to any kind of mens rea requirement. And we also agree that this is a felony that we're talking about, not a misdemeanor or a petty violation. And under the default rules that the Illinois legislature has set forward for how statutes of that type are to be construed, this court is left with two options. One is to say that the statute requires recklessness or more in terms of mens rea. The other is to say that the statute imposes absolute liability, strict liability. And in order to say that the statute imposes strict liability, this court would have to find that the legislature had clearly indicated an intention to impose strict liability.
Counsel, just to make it clear for the record, this is not only a felony offense, it's a non-probationable felony offense, is it not?
Absolutely, Your Honor. And that requires some labyrinthine statutory construction to find that out. It was not apparent until just before trial to the parties. And we see in the record at sentencing that the trial court was honestly dismayed at the fact that it was a non-probational felony. The trial court spoke at great length about its desire to impose some kind of non-custodial sentence. So this is a serious charge carrying serious punishment. And that, especially for someone like my client who doesn't have a substantial criminal record, that tends to show that this is not an absolute liability statute. We also, in comparison to other statutes that are absolute liability, there's something else in play as well, which is that this is about a constitutional right. The state cited repeatedly in its briefs to driving with license revoked, driving without your insurance, things like that. Those are canonical law school examples of strict liability statutes. The officer that pulls you over for going 75 in a 70 doesn't have to prove that you knew you were going 75, and that makes sense. But at the same time, the driving statutes are meant to confer a privilege. The default adult person in Illinois of sound mind and sound body can't get behind the wheel unless they've gone through the procedures of acquiring a driver's license and insurance. Well, the FOID Act doesn't impose a privilege. It controls, enforces, and organizes a constitutional right. The default adult person in the United States of sound mind and body not only has the ability, but the constitutional right to protect, to possess a firearm, whether in the home or outside of the home, for self-defense. And so here what we have is, if the FOID Act is strict liability, then all of a sudden this constitutional right could turn from a constitutional right into a non-probationable felony without someone's knowledge of that happening. And that simply can't be the case, especially in light of the statutory command that absolute liability in a serious case needs to be clearly specified by the legislature. There's no indication of that clear intent here. So with the statute not imposing absolute liability, then we go to Illinois' default rules for mens rea. And those rules clearly specify that negligence is not enough. There needs to be recklessness. There needs to be disregard of a risk of something happening in a way that that disregard is a gross deviation from the standard of care that a reasonable person would show.
So, Mr. Peterson, can you just walk us through what you think a case should look like in terms of the presentation of proof, or what the burden would be on the state in terms of establishing the requisite mens rea that you're arguing here? What kind of proof would be necessary?
Well, for one thing, Your Honor, they could show that they actually did mail notice of the ratification. There's actually no evidence in this case that they ever did mail it, only that they had the right address and it would have gone out. And in all the civil cases, all the civil, and I want to stress negligence cases that the state cites where having the right address and saying that it usually gets mailed under business practices raises a presumption of receipt, denial of receipt raises a fact issue. So for one thing, I would want the state to go through the usual business records evidence. I'd want them to say, we've got a note here in our files that we mailed it to her and we had her address right. Another thing is, if a defendant wishes to deny the mens rea, that could be handled the way that every other mens rea case is handled. If Ms. Fields wanted to get up on the stand and say, I never got notice of this, I thought that my FOID would only get revoked if I got convicted, the jury would get to decide if she was sincere. The jury would get to decide if that belief was reasonable. These would all become fact questions from the jury, for the jury. But here, the trial court treated it as strict liability.
So you're basically arguing then that she had to know that her FOID card was revoked.
Know or be reckless about it. And for instance, if she had been convicted of a felony and the trial court, upon convicting her of that felony and imposing sentence, informed her of all the usual collateral consequences that trial courts inform defendants of, they might lose their gun rights, they might risk deportation, all that. And then she said, well, I never got that form, so I assumed that they probably just kept my FOID valid. That would be an example of recklessness. But actually, here, what actually triggered her revocation, as a matter of fact, is complicated enough that I, as a trained lawyer, had to spend several hours, days, possibly even weeks figuring it out. The FOID statute that caused the revocation is one that says that if you are prohibited from acquiring or possessing firearms by federal law, you lose your FOID. Now, the federal law in question does not prohibit Ms. Fields from possessing a firearm. The Federal Gun Control Act forbids acquisition or sale of a firearm when you're charged with a felony. It only forbids possession when you're convicted. And that makes sense. The federal courts obviously don't want someone charged with felon in possession who knows that their gun will be forfeited to immediately sell it or give it to their neighbor. So this is a situation where an Illinois law triggered a provision of federal law that was itself triggered by a provision of Illinois law in a situation where it's complicated enough that it took me a major struggle to work it out with my colleagues. Ms. Fields is a layperson. She would absolutely be within the normal realm of standards of care for thinking, I have a constitutional right to do this. I keep my constitutional rights until I am convicted. But here, rather than on this evidence that we have, with no evidence of the fact that she was ever notified of the revocation, the evidence we have is that Ms. Fields, the first moment she was told she couldn't have her gun, the justice system's response to that was not to take her gun. It was to take her gun and convict her of a non-probationable felony.
Mr. Peterson, the sentencing provision under Section 14 says that she's guilty of a Class 3 felony if her FOID card is subject to revocation under Section 8. How do you explain that?
That raises the same problems. Frankly, Your Honor, it raises the problems even more about constitutional rights. And this is both the Second Amendment and the Fifth Amendment due process. To the extent that the FOID Act says that becoming subject to revocation leads one to automatically commit a non-probational felony, then we would submit that that's unconstitutional. That would mean that if a federal grand jury in Miami, Florida, had returned an indictment against Ms. Fields, she would have immediately become guilty of a non-probational felony, whether or not they told her. And we can see that this isn't what the statutory framework is being interpreted as by the Illinois State Police either. We see these two police officers in the car on the video discussing back and forth. She must have been told. She would have been notified. She absolutely would have been. We had at trial a records technician from the Illinois State Police talk about the process. If becoming subject to revocation was enough to trigger this, we wouldn't have seen that testimony. Frankly, I'm not sure that that position would even exist in the Illinois State Police. They could simply come and arrest you the moment you become subject to revocation. They wouldn't bother to tell you. So what I've put before this court, as I see it, is a way to read the FOID Act without its constitutionality becoming suspect. With a strict liability version of the FOID Act absolutely raises both Second and Fifth Amendment concerns. A non-strict liability of the FOID Act still has teeth, still enforces the regulations that the Illinois legislature intended it to enforce, but doesn't impose absolute liability and doesn't sweep in more than it constitutionally can.
So are you going to end up here in argument saying that the mens rea should be reckless?
Yes, Your Honor. Although with the default rules, if there was this kind of goes against the logic, but if there was somehow proof of absolute knowledge without proof of recklessness, then knowledge would be enough. The default rules say that any mens rea specified except for negligence is enough. But just with your standard model penal code understanding of how the mens rea states work, recklessness would be the lowest bar that the state needs to clear. And the state failed to clear it here. Ms. Fields had an absolutely reasonable understanding of how the charges in her other case would interact with her right to have a gun. She and her other case was not a gun case. So that's not even a consideration here. She simply had the belief that I have this constitutional right. I've gotten my FOID. I've gotten my concealed carry. And you can see on the video, the moment she tells the officer that she has, that it's her gun, she says, I've got my FOID, I've got my concealed carry, they're over there in my wallet. And he goes and gets them. So in her mind, she's not only possessed of this constitutional right to bear firearms, but she's following Illinois' rules. And no one's told her otherwise.
Counsel?
Yes.
I just want to interject a quick question. So if there's the type of evidence using business record exception that there was notice, it was sent to the House, there's presumption that she would have received it, what happens to your position?
It would weaken, Your Honor. It would.
Well, I guess maybe I should ask it this way. Would the state have met its burden? We know it didn't happen here. I'm not trying to put you in the spot.
No,
there's no proof of it, I should say.
With proof, for instance, that it was properly mailed. Let's say even that there's proof that a few weeks after the charges in her other case, after the preliminary hearing in her other case, there was proof that Ms. Fields had received an envelope from the Illinois State Police Firearms Division, and she'd left it there in a stack of unopened mail. That might be proof of recklessness, Your Honor. The state could concede, not necessarily enough to convince this particular jury, of course, but to meet the Jackson versus Virginia standard and make it so that a reasonable jury could have convicted, yes. But in that case, if that were true, Ms. Fields has been denied a chance to present a defense to this element. She wanted to get up there and testify that she hadn't. She wanted to put her credibility up against the officers. And I think that this court can see very well in this record that there was room for the jury to believe her, and there was room for the jury to believe the officer if that were the case. There wasn't. So in that position, if there had been that kind of evidence, then I think it would be entirely conceivable that this court would remand for a new trial with directions that the state's motion in limine to bar that testimony be denied. But what we had here wasn't even that. We usually send these out. They would have been mailed. And in a civil trial, you'd get the person from your records division to say, yeah, we send them out, you know, I've got the log, I always do this. We didn't have that in this case. So it's not enough even to meet the civil versions of the business records exemption, but also as I stated previously, if the state had done that and Ms. Fields had denied receipt, that would have become a question of fact for the jury. And the jury was denied that opportunity here. So if this court doesn't have further questions, I think I would rest on my briefs, and I'll be happy to answer any further questions at rebuttal.
Yeah, you didn't address the stop itself and the denial of the motion to suppress. I know you wanted to get in the argument that you just did, but I do want to ask you about the sufficiency of the evidence regarding the stop reasonable suspicion here. We have the officer's testimony that the exhaust was loud. Yes, you have a video that has an audio portion to it and which was played, but that was only of the car's engine, the vehicle's engine being revved on the shoulder. How do we know, why should we presume that the officer did not hear a very loud engine noise as that vehicle passed him at highway speed? It seems like you're asking us to doubt the officer's testimony in a vacuum here, because this video of what happened on the shoulder doesn't directly bear on what he also testified to regarding the vehicle at highway speed.
Your Honor, both the officer and the judge thought that it did directly bear on the previous noises. There's no claim in the record that it was louder when it was moving than when it revved.
But we're sitting here, and look, we all know that a vehicle's engine at highway speed RPMs is going to be louder than what we heard on the shoulder there. It doesn't replicate what the officer heard. So I don't think you can put them in that small of a box here.
Your Honor, when she revs her engine on the side of the road, the officer's reaction is, there it is, don't you see? He's pointing out the noise. He's pointing out what he describes later as loud as a motorcycle, a gurgling noise that is, I believe he testifies, louder than a 2008 Ford SUV specifically should be. He's pegging the noise that is on the tape to the noise when the car was moving and saying, that's the same thing, that's the problem, that's what gave me suspicion to stop you. So even by the officer's own testimony, it should be there on the tape if it exists. This court has its testimony, has the officer's testimony that he saw the violation right away, decided not to make a stop. And I see my time's expiring. May I briefly finish the answer and then conclude?
Finish, please.
That the officer testified that he decided not to make the stop. Then he saw my client and he found her lack of suspicious behavior suspicious. He saw her desire to continue singing. This is in 2019, the 4th of July was on a Thursday. This is the Saturday of 4th of July weekend. She's on her way back. She's singing along to the radio. And the officer testified that her normal, unfrightened behavior caught his eye and seemed weird. That's such compelling evidence of pretext that it should come to bear on the rest of the officer's testimony. But I would especially point this court to the fact that the officer described it as one noise that he heard three times, not three different noises. So your honors are in the position to view the noise for yourself and apply de novo review to what you hear. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. You will have rebuttal. Mr. Noefke, please.
May it please the court, counsel. I want to respond to the court's last question to begin with. It appears that counsel tends to concede that what is at issue here is the sound that the vehicle was making before the officer stopped it, and that's not something this court can really review. Can the court hear me?
I'm having a little difficulty. If you could speak up just a little, it would help me.
Okay. So that's really what the issue is, what the officer heard while the vehicle was traveling at highway speed. In the trial court's ruling, the trial court recognized that's what had to be the basis for the officer's stop. And the state admits that the officer's testimony was sufficient to support the stop. From that point on, everything that was discovered was just a cascade of events, really. I also want to address, as counsel did, the initial questions that the court had in supplemental briefing. And what I've got from our review was that Section 2A1 is a predicate provision for charging a number of different offenses under the FOID card act. One of those being the class 3 felony the defendant was charged with. It came out in questioning, that provision provides that a person could be charged even if they're subject to revocation, which it seems to me goes to the issue of whether they would have to have prior notice. For instance, if they just engaged in conduct which would support revocation, and they knew they engaged in conduct that supported revocation, that would be enough. I think there's sufficient evidence that defendant knew she was revoked or that she was subject to revocation just from her conduct on the video. She reluctantly conceded various things on the way to discovery of the firearm. Eventually, she said, "Oh, I might have a gun in the vehicle," as if one wouldn't know where their gun was. Then later on, that she said she thought, after she found out that the officer advised her that she was revoked, she said, "Oh, I thought we had to have a conviction." Well, there must have been some inquiry on her part because of her previous conduct or her previous status
Counsel, can I interject a question, please? I mean, it seems to be conjecture, because without a free, full, you know, admission, we're sort of sussing out the defendant's actions to prove up knowledge. I mean, is short of an admission, how does that get you there in terms of a notice understanding of the violation? I mean, a defendant's actions without, explain that to me.
Well, I mean, it seems the defendant was hesitant throughout the encounter to first advise the officer that she had a weapon. Then she said, "Well, she might have a weapon." And then, I didn't know that I could have a weapon barring a conviction, is, I guess, my answer to that. Sometimes you can tell things, and I know I said it one in our brief that the evidence that she knew was overwhelming, and I based that on really the just a common perception of you know, how someone acts or under certain circumstances. For example, it might be evident to the court that oral argument is not the most comfortable thing for me. I'd rather be briefing, but that same observation is something that the jury could have made in the video. How did she act when she was advised that the officers knew that she had been revoked? I think she acted in such a way that it was obvious that she knew that she had been revoked. Going to the notice requirement, I noticed that the testifying investigator on behalf of the state said that notice would have been mailed to her. The state would submit that's sufficient to show that it was mailed to her. I don't want to get into a discussion maybe of what is, how you define is, that type of thing, but I think that's sufficient to show that it was mailed.
Simply the statement that it should have been or normally is mailed is sufficient? Is that your position?
That's my position.
Did the defendant make that argument to the trial court? Did the defendant make an argument to the trial court that the notice was not mailed?
He did not. And I note that the statute provides for a notice by regular mail. The legislature could have asked, provided for a notice by certified or certified mail or registered mail, but it didn't. So that's obviously the notice that the legislature thought was sufficient. They had her correct address. Notice would have gone to that address. What would her defense be? I didn't pick up my mail. It didn't get there. Any defendant could claim that, because only regular mail was specified by the legislature. With respect to There's been some suggestions that the statute construed the way the state suggests would be unconstitutional, or at least there are have been suggestions in this argument. I would note that the defendant did not mount an outright constitutional challenge to the statute as written. I also note the defendant doesn't claim that she wasn't revoked. So those two things I think should be noted.
Mr. Nafke, at pages 27 and 28 of defendant's brief, she sets forth a scenario involving a grandmother who, with certain facts added to it, results in a conviction of a class 3 felony. Do you remember that?
I do recall that.
And I can't recall if you responded to that in the brief, in your brief. But can you just tell us here where she gets it wrong, or do you agree that there could be a situation, a scenario similar to what she describes that could result in a felony conviction where the defendant would be subject to absolute liability? And you remember, this is the grandmother is a patient in a mental health facility. She voluntarily checks in for a very short period of time for early stage Alzheimer's, released a week later with a clean bill of health, doesn't report it, and she doesn't set up a forwarding address. That's a second part of this. And the conduct then, I guess, would expose her to the non-probationable class 3 felony.
I don't really have a response to that insofar as that hypothetical, but we don't really have that situation here. I mean,
understood. We don't have it here, but a defendant is suggesting, based on the argument that the state is making here, that this could be a possible result given the facts, and it's not, you know, too far out of the realm of possibility. It's not, you know, that aliens have landed on Earth. This is something that, you know, possibly could happen. And so I'm just wondering if you had an answer to that.
I do not, other than the legislature is provided for notification by regular mail. That's what the legislature thought was sufficient. It seems like that supports, in at least to some degree, the state's argument that this would be an absolute liability offense. I have to go back to the wording of the statute that the state set forth, at least the part that requires the that deals with the punitive portion, that the person could be liable in the event that they were subject to revocation. As far as determining legislative intent, what does that mean? I mean, if you want to give it any meaning at all, it means that the person would be subject to liability without notice. If they commit certain conduct, they're subject to this liability. That's the answer I can give.
Thank you.
I'd certainly entertain any other questions the court has, but otherwise I would just stand on the arguments in the brief and invite any other questions the court might have. If none, then I would just ask that this court affirm the defendant's conviction.
I don't see any other questions. Any rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor. Thank you. I'd like to start out, first of all, with the point that the state and I do agree on. Counsel spoke of the cascade of events in the stop. We do agree that everything that happened between the initial stop and the finding of the firearm, we agree that that was all constitutionally acceptable. If the initial stop was supported by reasonable suspicion instead of mere pretext, then everything did chain together properly. We're not raising any kind of Fourth Amendment challenge about the investigation of the order of protection or the smell of marijuana, anything like that. Secondly, to some extent, I believe counsel for the other side is arguing about the meaning of the word is, because when Ms. Fields said that she might have a gun, the state is distinguishing between I might have a gun and I do have a gun. Yet when this records technician says it would have been sent, the state's saying that's functionally the same as it is sent. It can't work both ways. Third of all, I'd like to deal with the issue of Ms. Fields' hesitancy.
And counsel, let me stop you there. I'm asking the same question that I asked opposing counsel. Maybe I posed it to you, I don't remember, but what exactly did the defendant argue to the trial court about whether the notice was sent? Did the defendant argue that it was not sent? Or did the state just get by with this very loose testimony that would have been sent and that was never challenged? That's what I'm trying to figure out here.
She wasn't given the opportunity to challenge it, Your Honor. The state made a motion in limine to bar her testimony about whether or not she knew of the revocation. And once that motion in limine was granted, she chose not to testify because, in her words, there wouldn't be a point.
So when the state's witness says it would have been sent, defense counsel couldn't have objected? I mean, you can't challenge that statement? What do you mean it would have been sent? Was it sent? That's what's critical here. Was that challenge made to that general testimony?
I'm not entirely sure, Your Honor, but I believe it was not, because also by the time closing arguments had happened, defense counsel had been informed that her knowledge of whether or not she was revoked had no bearing on the statute. So the objection at that point would have been futile. The trial court had already said her knowledge doesn't matter here. So the issue of whether or not it's sent, it only matters if the trial court reads the statute correctly instead of the way it did. So that challenge would have been entirely futile.
How did the trial court read the statute incorrectly?
The trial court essentially read it as absolute liability, Your Honor. The trial court said that the two elements of the crime here were knowing possession of the firearm and the fact of the revocation. So at that ruling makes the issue of whether or not it was actually sent irrelevant. It makes it not a thing that defense counsel could have fought once he lost that ruling.
Well, you still have the knowing possession of the firearm. That's a mental element.
That's right, Your Honor.
Okay, so it can't be absolute liability according to the case law.
The case law specifies, Your Honor, that these default mens rea rules have a different default for possession elements. Possession with no mens rea listed is presumed to be knowing possession required. All of the other elements are the ones where recklessness or more is required.
What case says that?
It's in the statute, Your Honor, and it's the default mens rea statutes. I believe that's section.
Yeah, 22. I've got those statutes.
Yes. So that comes from the default rules saying there's sections 4.4, 4.5, 4.6, and 4.7 explain the meanings of these rules. And the rest of that section, all of the four dashes, say possession, we read in the word knowing. All other elements, we read in more than negligence.
Subsection C of section 4-3 regarding mental states says knowledge that certain conduct constitutes an offense or knowledge of the existence, meaning, or application of the statute defining an offense is not an element of the offense. So if one of those factors in Section 8 occurs, that's in the statute, and that section tells me that your client is presumed to know that. That's the law. And what you seem to be arguing is that would be ignorance of the law, which is not the defense. Where am I wrong there?
You can. Thank you, Your Honor. I believe what we're dealing with here is the difference about whether she knew that keeping her firearm once she was revoked would be illegal versus whether or not she knew that she was revoked. I think she, like any other law-abiding citizen, would know if your right to possess a gun has been revoked, that that becomes illegal. So that's what subsection C is doing there. It's saying you can't raise as a defense the fact that you didn't know that this was banned by statute. She knew that possessing her gun, if she were revoked, was illegal. She didn't know that she was revoked.
How about subject to revocation?
The subject to revocation, I think reading the FOID Act as a whole renders that provision dead letter. Speaking of this grandmother that I brought up in my brief, I'd like to speak about that particular reason for revocation.
You are technically out of time, but I do want to hear your response, because Justice Harris asked that question, and it's a very good question, and we'd like to get your side of it.
Thank you, Your Honor, and I'll keep it very short. The 430 ILC 65-8C, the mental health where you voluntarily check in provision, allows a doctor to certify that you're not a harm to yourself or others, and that makes your FOID no longer subject to revocation. The period between your check-in and doctor's certification, if that subject to revocation provision has any real teeth, is a period where at any moment a state trooper can arrest you for a non-probationable felony. If the statute as a whole has a provision where something could look like it's leading towards revocation and then be pulled back, reading subject to revocation as triggering a non-probational felony writes that out of the statute as well. There are no further questions. Thank you.
Justice Kavanaugh, Justice Harris, do you have questions, either of you?
No, thank you.
Okay, thank you. I guess that concludes the arguments. Thanks to both of you. The case is submitted and the court stands in recess.